listener to be cleverly played with by the punchline. Jokes about Jews are not really about Jews. They're about manipulating the mind of the listener, who will recognize what gaps need to be filled in based on a pre-existing narrative. When you hear a joke about a Jew, you think about the character you know the joke is about, cheap and clever. When you hear a Polish or a blonde joke, you think about the character who is stupid. These jokes are not about blonde Polish Jews. They're about characters that have one or two properties that identify them, and your mind naturally fills in gaps accordingly. Accordingly and predictably, thereby allowing your mind to be tricked by the punchline. When you figure out how the punchline can be understood in association with the setup and the character or characters in the joke, you get it and find it amusing if it was a well-crafted joke and not amusing if it was a poorly crafted joke. The content is only there for the psychological priming. The joke's not about the content. It's about the quality of the mental manipulation. That, and that alone, comic amoralists argue, is what accounts for the funniness of the joke. If this is true, then comic moralists and comic immoralists both miss the point. They both contend that the content of the joke affects its funniness. But all the content, moral and otherwise, the amoralists argue, is irrelevant to the funniness score. As such, we might condemn someone for telling an immoral joke, but while we may consider them a bad person who did a bad thing, they would not necessarily be a teller of bad jokes. So, we're left with the question we began with. Does the moral content of a joke affect its funniness? Consider this joke. What do you get if you cross a great painter and a very rude person? Figure it out yourself. Now that is immoral.
Lecture 20, Situational Ethics and Humor.
Oh, another shrimp on the Barbie. Oh, hey, Steve.
How's it going, Jeff?
Oh, pretty good, you know. Been struggling. Been looking to read something, you know, like a presidential biography, but I can't figure out what I want to read. I've been thinking about Abraham Lincoln, a biography on him, because, you know, Abraham Lincoln's always worth a shot. Too soon? William McKinley. Okay. Kennedy.
Back in the 1980s, the term situational ethics was used as a boogeyman. It seemed to imply that one was not committed to one's values. They were merely situational. But the fact is that ethics must be situational. The context matters in determining whether an act is right or wrong. If I walk up to a woman and ask her to go to bed with me, it matters whether that woman is my wife or not. Situation is important in ethics. We will look at three ways in which situation may be relevant to the morality of joke telling. We'll examine when, where, and what. The when question is a matter of timing. When a joke about a touchy contemporary issue falls flat, comedians will ask, "Too soon?" We will look at whether there is a comedic waiting period that must be considered morally relevant. The where issue looks at location. Is joking in certain places or at certain events, say at a funeral, completely morally forbidden? The what question looks at topics. Are there some topics that should never be joked about? Topics so sacred or touchy that any humorous treatment ought to be considered ethically off limits? These questions are situational, because they're not asking about the moral status of the jokes themselves in a universal sense, but rather about which contextual factors are morally relevant when judging the acceptability of a joke that's been told. Let's start with time. On the one hand, there's the simple pragmatic question, too soon. Comedians have a goal. They want to get their audience to laugh. eliciting laughter is the result of psychological manipulation of the minds of the listeners. Sometimes there will be confounding factors that will cause a good joke to bomb. When you know a joke is tightly worded and well-crafted, you expect a good laugh. And when you don't get one, you wonder, what happened? The question, too soon, could simply mean, will this joke land better next week? But our question's different. It's not a question about effectiveness. It's a question of morality. Our question is this. Is there a period of time after a tragic event when it's ethically required that we provide a comedy-free environment for processing? Is there an amount of time after a tragedy when it's morally problematic to use that event as the premise or butt of a joke? We're not saying that one can never joke about this topic, but rather considering if moral respect requires a cooling-off period, a waiting period before doing so. This line of argument claims that too soon is a moral notion. The argument that there ought to be a temporary moratorium on humor based on a tragic event is a utilitarian argument based on the pain of the survivors. Note that it cannot be a deontological argument based on the dignity of the victims, because we are arguing that if we're far enough away in time, the jokes would be allowable. Yet, the victims remain victims. So, any moral reasoning that leads to the need to wait a bit before joking about something must be based on the effects of the joking and how the effects themselves are a function of time. The argument has, at its heart, the oft-repeated chestnut that comedy is tragedy plus time. We see things differently from different vantage points. When wounds are fresh, they're painful to touch. But after they've scarred over, they no longer hurt and may even have lost the ability to sense when they're being touched, no matter how roughly. Metaphorical wounds of the heart may be the same. When a tragedy is fresh in our minds, we're more sensitive. But with respect to the heart, time heals all wounds, and after a while, we can think about the matter without pain or grief. If this is the case, then any mention of the tragedy soon afterwards will induce pain. Jokes are trivial mentions. Jokes are unnecessary. As such, the argument goes, joking about the tragedy before the hearts of those grieving for the victims have had time to heal is a source of unnecessary pain. And for a utilitarian, causing unnecessary pain is exactly what makes something morally wrong. It's become a cliche to respond to someone who asks about a tangential element of a tragic event with the common joke, "Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how'd you like the play?" On this line, there's nothing morally problematic about the joke because enough time has passed that we may use the assassination of the president as the basis for a joke. But there are other events for which this is not true. In interviews, Mel Brooks said he had no problem in his film History of the World Part 1 making light of the Inquisition. But he could not bring himself to do the same with respect to the Holocaust. He, of course, is more than fine mocking Hitler himself or Nazism. See, for example, the magnificent opening number of Springtime for Hitler in The Producers. But mocking Hitler is not the same as trying to humorize the genocide of the Holocaust. Even though both the Inquisition and the Holocaust were evil, murderous attempts to eliminate Jews, the difference in time, Mel Brooks contends, makes a difference in what one should be allowed to joke about. The argument against morally requiring a temporary moratorium on joking, that there's never an ethical reason to say too soon, is also a utilitarian argument. It's not a rights-based free speech defense or a deontological argument that comedians always have a duty to make jokes whenever they can. Rather, it's an attempt to refute the claim of harm caused by the jokes soon after the event. There are two sorts of utilitarian arguments that have been put forward. Comedian Anthony Jeselnik is a star of shock comedy. His shtick is to find the line of acceptability and proudly and explicitly step across it. He made a joke on Twitter hours after the Boston Marathon bombing that was a variant of, other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you like the show? He tweeted out, there are some lines that just shouldn't be crossed today, especially the finish line. The result was people complaining to Comedy Central, on which he had an eponymous program, and the network demanding that he pull down the joke and issue an apology. Jeselnik maintains that the joke was not harmful because it did not actually affect the victims. Victims of tragic events like this, he argues, are not on Twitter immediately following the tragedy. Roseanne Barr takes a slightly different tack in arguing that there ought not be a too-soon concern for comedians at all. She argues that the joking can be healing for victims. In public discussions of humor ethics and the moral constraints on comedians, Roseanne has argued that we're wrong to think of jokes as inflammatory. We should see them as soothing. When a tragedy befalls us, we see that event as bigger than life, focusing on it solely as it affected us. But humor performs a function that little else in life does, a function that's both useful and helpful. Humor gives us distance from its object. The way most jokes work is to remove something from its usual context and show it to us in an unexpected way. Seeing the thing from a different angle can often give us insight that we would never have had from our standard vantage point. This is true, she argues, for tragic events as well. When tragedy overwhelms us, we cannot heal the heart. Joking forces us to put some distance between us and the event, and this healthy distance puts the heart in a lighter mood, facilitating its healing. Joking about tragedy is how many comedians work through their own problems. And when they perform for others who have suffered similarly, the honesty of the joke, the willingness to look right at the harm and the hurt and to make something creative out of it, brings the comic and the audience together. And that sort of care-based gesture does not overwhelm, but creates a communal place where victims can begin the healing process. Humor is never too soon. If it were, you'd be telling the victims that it's too soon to start healing themselves. These considerations are all connected with time. Is there something morally important about time, or do the same sorts of concerns hold for space? Are there places that ought to be humor-free zones? Are there specific locations at which it's morally improper to tell jokes? There are places that we set aside as sacred spaces, spaces dedicated to somber or non-playful occasions. Cemeteries and funerals, churches and other houses of worship, wedding ceremonies, monuments and memorials. Events at those places are designed to be somber and sober. The argument that such events and the spaces in which they take place should be humor-free zones is based on the view that humor is inherently unserious. Humor is the opposite of seriousness. When we insert humor into an occasion, we make the situation lighter. Lightening a situation is often a good idea. It makes it more enjoyable. It brings people together around laughter and fun. It creates a general sense of lightheartedness. All else being equal, these are wonderful things. But, the line goes, to everything there is a season. There's a time to laugh and a time to weep, a time to build up and a time to break down, a time to dance and a time to mourn. There are times to be serious, and there are places which are dedicated to being the locations where we go for seriousness. Human life has its buoyant, joyous times, and these should be celebrated wholeheartedly. But life also contains somber, grave elements. These too deserve their due. When we deal with remembrances of tragedies, or acceptance of sacredness, or commitment to great and noble callings, we need to do so with a fully serious mind. We set aside these spaces and events for quiet meditation. The reason is that this sort of silent meditation opens the mind to be able to move beyond itself. We turn the thing over in our heads. We draw connections. We see the object of consideration in greater depth. we move beyond our previous shallower understanding to a place of intellectual, emotional, or spiritual depth. When we laugh at something, on the other hand, we remove ourselves from the connection with it. A serious mind can contemplate the nature of that which transcends us, but laughter focuses the mind on the source of humor and does not allow you to move beyond it. Laughter traps the mind. You can't have an insight or a deep connection when you laugh. And you disturb others. They become distracted. Laughter can be infectious. Their thoughts are flattened by your jocularity. You poison the environment, making it unable to perform its job of giving rise to transcendent wisdom, which requires the created solemnity with which the place was supposed to be endowed. As such, these places, in order to perform their roles, must remain humor-free. To joke in such a place is to undermine the value of the place, to disallow it to perform its socially necessary function. That is immoral, the line goes. The objection to this argument, the view that humor may not always be appropriate, but there ought never be a designated non-humor zone, contends that the argument we just considered is wrong to hold that humor and seriousness are mutually exclusive. One can allow that there are spaces designed to honor those who have sacrificed, innocent victims who have perished, or sacred covenants to be revered, and still contend that these functions can be carried out in the presence of humor. Indeed, humor may play a role in such honoring, remembering, and revering. Humor can certainly be used to diminish. Humorous insults can be very effective. Silliness can strip away pretension. There's no doubt that there are some uses of humor which can, in some places and for some events, undermine solemnity. But to claim that this is universally true of humor is to paint with far too broad a brush. Humor can do exactly what it is that we want done at these places for these events. Humor does not shut down the mind, but is capable of opening it up, of allowing it to see things in a more multifaceted way than we otherwise might. A primary mode of humor is the disclosure of incongruities. Those incongruities can often involve the thing as opposed to the way we see the thing. Consider the ancient discussion of the blind man describing the elephant. We see from our perspective and assure ourselves that the thing is as we see it and is only what we see of it. But of course, so often in life, it's more. What a well-crafted joke is capable of doing is exposing that to us. Humor is capable of making us see beyond our limited perspective. Humor, at its best, can be transcendental. This is why Zen koans are formulated as seeming contradictions, and why you often see contrasting interpretations in the Jewish Talmud. The idea is that the grappling with the incongruity will open the mind to the larger truth. It's one place where you can gain wisdom from both koans and koans. It's not argued that we should stop setting aside places to seek transcendence, but the argument that humor necessarily inhibits this is false, the line goes. Can it? Absolutely. We can diminish a thing using humor, but, this side argues, so too can we elevate it. So, we've seen both sides of the where debate. Are there places where one ought not make jokes? Remains a good question. But what of the what question? Are there certain topics or certain people or groups that ought to be completely off limits to joking? Are there certain things we should just never joke about? This is a debate that embroiled two well-known philosophers in the 18th century. The first I want to talk about is Anthony Ashley Cooper, who is the third Earl of Shaftesbury and is usually simply known as Shaftesbury. He was a writer of both philosophical essays and plays, some of which were comedies. The butt of his jokes in these comedies were often the religious fundamentalists of the time. During that period, Puritans and Quakers advocated a very dour form of Christianity. According to these theological perspectives, bodily pleasures were sinful as they distract from the sacred. We ought to live dedicated lives of unmitigated devotion to God, and this requires a constant, unwavering concentration on the life of the soul. Christ suffered, and we should emulate him, not seek out hedonistic delight. Humor, amongst other jovialities, is intrinsically problematic. Shaftesbury could not disagree more. If humans are the children of God, then surely a loving God would want his children to be happy. God did not give us this world and this life in order for us to wallow in misery. If you give someone a gift, you want that person to enjoy the gift, to have an enriched life in which the gift brings them happiness. If your friend refuses to allow himself the full pleasure that the gift was intended to bring, then the friend has misused the gift and refused to accept your generosity. That would be an act of rudeness. Likewise, Shaftesbury contends, if we live a life of unfettered seriousness, refusing to embrace the joys and pleasures it can contain, then we've insulted the God that gave us the life. Far from being more righteous because of their unrelenting seriousness, Shaftesbury argues these religious wet blankets are insulting God with their way of honoring him. We ought to enjoy good fellowship. We ought to be sociable. We ought not be buffoons, surely. But there is a moderate degree of good cheer, which shows God that we fully appreciate the life we've been given. Since they refused to live moderate lives of good cheer, Shaftesbury took aim at the religious fundamentalists and their theology of seriousness in his plays. Raillery, in the parlance of his time, involved making fun of a group, and he argued they deserved the mockery. Gottfried Leibniz was another of the most important thinkers of that period, and Shaftesbury's work concerned him. Is there a point at which satirizing a brand of Christian theology becomes a matter of satirizing God himself? Surely making fun of God is a sacrilege. God is sacred, but in joking at his expense, you have turned him into a mere object of your play. This is to profane God in the most clear and troubling way. God has become a mere tool for generating giggles. This is not the sort of behavior demanded by that being who deserves the utmost respect. Make fun of the errors of these dour sticks in the mud if you must, but leave their religion, especially leave God, out of it. Leibniz argued that there is at least one thing that we ought never make jokes about, God. The question here is not metaphysical, right? Let's not worry about whether a God exists, and if so, which one. Let's generalize the Leibnizian view, though, because there's something interesting and important in it. What Leibniz is arguing is that to make a joke about something is to diminish it, or at least to put it in a category of the blasphemous, the normal, the ordinary. We can joke about the aspects of daily life because they're worldly. But are there not some things we want to elevate above the ordinary? Are there not some things we want to contend are special? If so, they deserve reverence. What does it mean to revere something? We revere Paul if we separate him from the rest of life and, metaphorically, or literally as with a statue, put him on a pedestal. That pedestal elevates the subject, and that elevation comes with not only adoration, but also a sense that the subject is deserving of special status and treatment. To make a joke about something is to treat it like a tool, like an object for our own use, a mere means for our ends. It's not an end in itself. It denies it dignity. We make jokes about things in order to generate the pleasure that accompanies laughter. Humor is a tool we use for our own happiness. To make a joke about something, this Leibnizian line goes, is to place the status of the thing joked about beneath my own. All jokes are put-downs in a sense. Recall that superiority theorists like Plato Thomas Hobbes, and Roger Scruton have argued along these lines. If this is true, then any time I take something that has a status above my own and I make a joke about it, what I'm doing is removing the superior thing from its rightful place above me and demoting it below me. When I make a joke about those who deserve reverence, when I treat them irreverently, I demean those who ought to be beyond my insult. Such entities, which are placed beyond joking, we call sacred cows. How does one achieve such a status? Well, there are several ways. One could live a life of greatness or sacrifice. War heroes, great statesmen, martyrs, or saints may have lived lives that we ought to admire. These are people who, through their deeds or way of being, have elevated themselves. They're better than the rest of us because of what they did. To joke about them is to place those who lived exemplary lives below the rest of us slobs who have not their greatness, bravery, or commitment. Another way is to have suffered while innocent. When one is an innocent victim, there's a special status we afford you. Victims of natural disasters are to be pitied. They lost their livelihood, possessions, or even lives as a result of an event they had no hand in causing, no way of preventing, and no responsibility for. This could have been any one of us. But when it's them, their harm elevates them to a protected status. Same with the innocent victims of human violence and crime. Harm to anyone is unfortunate. But when it's children who are harmed or die, like those in the Omagh bombing in Ireland, or the Oklahoma City bombing, or in any of the multitude of school shootings in the United States, there is, again, something especially troubling. And the result is that the victims are elevated to a place where we honor them in our mourning. They become comically untouchable. To make jokes about them is to take away the status we grant to those who suffered. Reconsider the case we discussed in an earlier lecture, Daniel Tosh's interaction with an audience member over rape jokes. Is rape a sacred cow? Rape culture is endemic and leads to injustice, pain, unfulfilled potential that can be found in both small and tremendous ways in the lives of victims. When we make rape jokes, the line goes, we make rape something normal, something lighthearted, something not to be taken seriously. This only sets the stage for its continuance. We harm real people by making light of rape. As such, it follows that these are things we should never joke about. It's not merely the pragmatic problem that jokes about these are not funny or won't get laughs. The question is not whether one could be funny about rape, the Holocaust, or World War II veterans. Rather, it's a moral prohibition that's being claimed here. One ought not to make jokes about these protected individuals, groups, or topics. To do so minimizes that which should not be minimized, either because it's deserving of being held above the normal, or because in minimizing it, we diminish its importance and halt possible social progress. The argument on the other side, however, takes that there should be no prohibition on the topics of jokes. Nothing is or ought to be off limits to humor. The counter-argument offered is twofold. First, that being the subject of a joke is not a harm or degradation. Second, humor performs social work that is so important that any limits that could disable it would be more of a harm than any individual joke could be. The first argument contends that the blanket claim that being the subject of a joke is a harm is false. It's certainly true that we can use humor as a weapon. Anyone who ever walked on a third grade playground knows that humor can be used to harm others. But the claim needed is not just that humor can be harmful, but that by its nature, it is always degrading to those who are the butt of a joke. Making a joke about someone is often called making a joke at that person's expense. That is, the joke costs the subject something. What's the cost? Respect, status, privileged place. If we joke about something, we bring it down. But is this true? Are there exalted uses of humor? Can we build something up with a joke? Can we use a humorous utterance to lift something above the rest?
Negro League Hall of Famer Cool Papa Bell is renowned for being the fastest player to ever play professional baseball. How fast was he? It is said that Cool Papa Bell was so fast, he could hit a line drive up the middle and have to duck at second base so it wouldn't hit him in the head. He was so fast that he could turn out the lights and be in bed before it got dark.
These are jokes, but being the subject of them does not make the legendary baseball star less admired. The nature of the joke further cements his legendary status. It doesn't bring him down with the rest of us or below us, but strengthens the pedestal on which we place him. The second line is that humor is an important part of society. Comedians are able to use jokes to say things the rest of us are not able to say. We need jokes to speak truth to power. In Shakespeare, for example, it's only the fool who can speak truth to the king. We have a lot of topics that we avoid in polite conversation. There are aspects of the world which we, especially in a democratic society, need to grapple with, that we refuse to talk about directly. But using humor, we can. We expose things with humor we might otherwise not see. Humor can be a social corrective. Shaftesbury argued that the only things capable of being lampooned are those which are false. Try being funny with 2 + 2 = 4. You can't. Humor, Shaftesbury said, is a test of truth. When we limit what can be joked about, when we say you can no longer joke about X, we shut ourselves off to asking the hard questions about X. We risk allowing ourselves to accept continued unchallenged falsity about X. If we can't joke about something, we probably can't talk about it. And if we don't talk about it, we don't think critically about it. And if we don't think critically about it, we are likely holding false beliefs about it. This is especially dangerous when X involves political power. What are we forbidden to joke about? Usually that which protects the powerful. If the powerful are not treated critically, that leads to oppression. So, yes, there might be some topics that cause discomfort when we joke about them. But if we eliminate them from the possibility of joking, we open the door to not being able to joke about a range of things that we need to have as a part of our discourse. It's a small price to pay, the line goes, to save the critical faculties of the society that we're allowed to tell a few jokes about things we hold dear. So, are there times we shouldn't joke? Are there places we shouldn't joke? Are there things we shouldn't joke about? As is always the case in philosophy, it's complicated.
Lecture 21, The Necessity of Humor.
Yeah, so today is blue. What's tomorrow?
Fuchsia.
Oh, God, I have to wash that.
My wife got this for me.
That's nice. Your wife got this for me, too.
Yeah. I got the mail.
Heard a good one. So, the Pope and a lawyer die at exactly the same time. There they are in front of the pearly gates, and St. Peter looks into his book and says to both of them, "Congratulations, you're welcome into the kingdom of heaven." So the Pope and the lawyer walk through the gates, and there, St. Peter, he's got a little golf cart. They both hop in, and he's driving down the street. He stops in front of this huge mansion. St. Peter turns to the lawyer and says, "This is where you will be spending all of eternity." Lawyer gets out, walks into the house. They get back into the golf cart. St. Peter drives away, goes down 2 blocks, turns left, stops in front of this nondescript little row house. Says to the Pope, "This is where you will be spending all of eternity." The Pope looks at it, and he says, "St. Peter, I don't mean to sound ungrateful, but I was a pope. He was a lawyer. He gets this huge mansion, and I get this?" St. Peter looks at him and says, "Popes we got plenty of, but lawyers?"
Not bad.
Are you even human? We all love humor. Humor's good. Humor is funny. I'm a philosopher. I say deep things. But what we're going to be concerned with is the broader question, is humor necessary? Could you live a truly human life without humor? Are we wired for humor? Does having a human mind require humor? Now, the answer to this question depends, of course, on what we mean by a human mind. The development of this concept through the history of Western thought is deserving of its own lecture series, several of which are available from the great courses we work on commission. The writers of classical times equated the concept of mind with soul. In Greek, Roman, and early Jewish and Christian thinkers, the concept of mind is the seat of the will, that which makes our decisions for us. The central question underlying all Greek thought, when inherited by the Romans, was, why do things change? We know why they stay the same. That's how they are. But why do they change? What brings about the change? And why do they change in that way? This focus leads many classical Greek and Roman thinkers to follow in the footsteps of Aristotle, who thought that all change is goal-directed, albeit beings have what he called a telos, that is, an end, a goal, an aim they're trying to achieve. This is true, Aristotle held, of all change. Say I had a pen in my hand. If I drop my pen, it falls. That means that the pen has a goal, to be down there. And it must have an internal source of change, a soul that's driving it to move as it does. Yes, pens and all other material things have a sort of soul, according to Aristotle. My pen, by a virtue of being composed of earth and water, has one set of internal drives. But living things have others. Plants eat and grow. These changes require an additional part to their souls to accomplish these changes. Animals eat and grow, but they also perceive and move. Hence, they must have an even more complicated soul. Humans do all of this as well, but we also reason. So we must have an even more complicated soul with additional parts. Is humor a mark of a well-functioning human soul? We'll discuss this in much more detail in an upcoming lecture, but according to Aristotle, it is. Too much humor, being a buffoon, is morally problematic as it keeps you from fully reaching your potential as a human being. But so too does having no humor. A moderate amount of humor is essential. That is, of the very essence of being human. Now, for some early Christian writers, such as St. Augustine, for example, there is a very different conception of what it is to be human because they have a different notion of soul. Humans are a combination of two distinct sorts of things, a material body and an immaterial soul. When the body dies, the soul is liberated, freed from its captivity within the body, and goes to its eternal resting place once it's been judged. Why is it the soul that gets judged for the life lived, for the good acts and the sins committed, for the pleasures enjoyed and the pains endured? It was the body that committed the sin and the body that enjoyed the pleasure. So why is it the soul that gets judged? Because the soul is in charge. The body's only following orders. The body is mere matter. It cannot do what it wants. It's under the management of the soul, which controls volition. The body is a puppet and the soul is the puppeteer. The body is the tool and the soul is the carpenter. When the soul has decided what it wants, we say, I've made up my mind. The soul, in this classical understanding, is the mind. That's why it's the soul that gets judged. Humans are a combination of two completely distinct kinds of stuff. In philosophy, this is called metaphysical dualism. That means that reality contains two entirely distinct types of substances. On the one hand, there's matter, which has properties like mass, position, shape, and color. Then, on the other hand, there's mind, which lacks these properties, but has others like reason, will, desire. Humans, and humans alone, are a combination of the two kinds of stuff. We live our lives in the world of matter, but But upon death, we're moved to the realm of the non-material. And based on how we controlled our material self, it's determined which part of the non-material world our non-material soul will inhabit. Notice that this requires the mind to be the same as the soul if the judgment is to make any sense. This continues beyond classical Christian thought into the Enlightenment period, in which humanity is defined by its rationality. For thinkers like René Descartes and Thomas Hobbes, we can ask whether humor is a necessary part of a well-functioning rational soul. There were, of course, very different theological takes on this question. In a previous lecture, we saw that this was a central question of Anthony Ashley Cooper, the third Earl of Shaftesbury. Shaftesbury saw groups of religious fundamentalists arguing the negative side of this question. Humor, like all other bodily pleasures, ought to be eschewed by a righteous person. We need to live a serious life of piety and suffering. That's the appropriate way of being that leads to eternal reward. Shaftesbury, on the other hand, argued that a loving God would not have created a world with the possibility of joy and pleasure, including, indeed especially, humor, if he had not wanted his children to enjoy it. We ought to be good-humored. Yes, too much would lead to a drunkenness of the soul, and humor at inappropriate objects, specifically the true, would be problematic. But the appropriate amount of good humor at the appropriate aspects of the world, that is, the false, is agreeable to us, and should be, because that's the mark of a well-functioning spirit. To deny the soul its good, clean, fun of enjoying incongruity of the false is to misuse the soul. Humor is necessary to allow us to fully instantiate the being which God has given us in his image. We find the absurd to be funny because that's how we were made. We delight in the absurd because we should. We're rational beings, and irrationality ought to strike a rational being as odd. The oddity of certain kinds of irrationality should be bothersome, but in other lighter cases, the irrationality should incite good cheer because we've detected it and we're able to correct it. The resumption of rationality is a happy thing to rational beings, and that is what humor at its best can achieve. This view of the necessity of humor as a self and societal corrective will be discussed in a later lecture in more detail, but notice that this form of the argument presumes that human beings are, by nature, rational beings. But are we? The 19th century reaction to the rationalism of the 17th and 18th century Enlightenment took issue with this. In the 19th century, we see writers like Friedrich Nietzsche embracing the passions. The Enlightenment sought to elevate the rational and diminish or completely eliminate the irrational, the emotional. When we act, we have to choose between what we want and what we think. There's the heart and the mind, and they are at odds with each other. And the Enlightenment thinkers urged us to always follow the mind. The 19th century Romantic reaction was to reject this whole cloth and take it in the other direction. We need to reject reason as the basis for our actions and embrace the passions, embrace the emotions, embrace the irrational. For this reason, some 19th century writers argue we need to embrace humor as a necessary part of life. Human life without humor leads to a broken, incomplete, or unexpressed human soul. The most important writer of this movement for our purposes is the Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard was a peculiar man, and that's putting it lightly. He wrote great books of philosophy under multiple pseudonyms, although everyone knew it was him in all cases. These different characters he would inhabit wrote in opposition to each other. Kierkegaard's alter egos had extended public philosophical disputes with one another. When you read Kierkegaard's works, you're stepping into a Punch and Judy type puppet show in which a single puppeteer is using his left hand to bash his right, while his right hand fights back against the left. We begin in the realm of the absurd, and trust me, we're going to stay there. Humanity, Kierkegaard argues, is placed in a strange position. We're in a world in which we're given reason, which is capable of determining some truths, but the greatest truths are such that they completely elude reason. Consider ethics. How ought we to act? It seems like reason determines what's morally right and morally wrong. Is it morally wrong to murder? Absolutely. Is it morally wrong to murder your own child? Even more so. Why? It could be a matter of human dignity. Could be the right to life. It could be that to kill someone is the ultimate harm. It could be the nature of the care-based relationship between the parent and child. According to all our ethical systems, it is morally wrong to murder your own child. Kierkegaard points this out. And then he asks about the story of Abraham and Isaac. Abraham was told by God to sacrifice his only child as a test of devotion. And he led Isaac into the wilderness and bound him, raising the knife to murder him. Now, fortunately for Isaac, he was stopped. But the intention to murder was there. How do we think of Abraham for this action? We exalt him as a great and righteous man. What he did was good. But what he did was immoral. Killing your own child is immoral, yes. But Kierkegaard argues that goodness is not the same thing as morality. Morality is the part of goodness that's governed by reason. But goodness outruns reason. The Enlightenment thinkers weren't wrong, just wrongly limited. They restricted us to the part of life that resides within the boundaries of reason. But truth outruns reason. This boundary is the line between rationality and irrationality. And Kierkegaard argues that that line is God. God is that truth that resides beyond the boundary of reason. Just like Abraham, if we want to be good, if we want to be righteous, we cannot allow ourselves to be limited by reason. We cannot be constrained by logic. We must embrace the irrational, the absurd. This embrace is faith. We must, in Kierkegaard's famous phrase, take a leap of faith. That leap is a jump off the edge of our reason into the abyss of that which cannot be known rationally. There cannot be a good reason to believe in God because God is what lies beyond reason. But the leap of faith is not a blind leap. It's a leap that follows a very definite trajectory. There's an intellectual road that leads to true faith, and that road, Kierkegaard contends, requires humor. The journey into the irrational proceeds through four definite stages. Okay, think of each stage as the floor of a four-story building. The basement is aesthetics or beauty. The second floor is ethics. The third floor is natural religion, that is, religion known by reason without the need for divine revelation. And the fourth highest floor is Christianity. What you do is explore each floor, trying to find all the truths that are scattered about on it. You can't move to the next floor until you've accumulated and understood all the truths on the floor you currently occupy. Your goal is to collect and digest all of the truths until you reach the top floor. As you roam about collecting these truths on the first floor, you suddenly find that some of them conflict with each other. They can't both be truths since they're contradictory. What do? You can't hold them both, but you'll need both on the next floor in which understanding higher level truths requires knowing the lower level ones. Now, there's an elevator that takes you between floors, but that elevator requires a key to be found in understanding the truths you've collected on that level. The key is to be found in synthesizing the rationally incompatible truths. You need to learn how to reach an understanding of rationally irreconcilable truths in order to get the elevator to move up. What's the ability to reconcile logical incongruities? Yep, it's exactly what we think it is. At first, there will be frustration and anger at being trapped by a contradiction. We'll lean on reason and find ourselves stuck. But then we will free our minds from the strictures of rationality and delight in the incongruity. The key to the elevator from the first to the second floor is an understanding of irony. We then move to the second level, where we find more incompatible truths of a higher level. The key to get us from the second to the third floor of the building is humor. You must understand humor to develop as a human and acquire religious truth. One cannot be religious, Kierkegaard argues, without a sense of humor. It's not possible. Irony and humor are the parts of the human mind required for reaching natural religion, especially and ultimately Christianity. Faith, modeled on irony and humor, is then the last step that takes us to full humanity, full religiosity, full actualization of ourselves as children of God. According to the doctrine of the Trinity, we are supposed to believe that God is one thing and also three. One equals three is surely an absurdity. Yet to gain access to the truths of Christianity, we must accept it. Humor prepares the mind for exactly this. We cannot be the people we could be, the people we should strive to be, without being people who understand and appreciate humor. Humor is necessary for a properly lived human life. This notion of irrationality as a necessary part of the human mind, and thereby humor as a necessary part of the human mind, leaked out of the religious and philosophical work of the end of the 19th century and found its way into the science of the times as well. At the start of the 20th century, the Enlightenment picture of mind was challenged by the psychological community. Most famous among this group, Sigmund Freud. Now, in an earlier lecture, we examined Freud's theory of humor. Let's remind ourselves quickly of where Freud contends humor comes from and why the mind would break itself without humor. The Freudian mind, again, is composed of three parts. The id, housing our basic animal urges, the ego, or conscious mind, and the superego, or conscience. The id and the superego constantly battle with each other. This takes energy, both to fight and to keep it sublimated below the threshold of consciousness. This friction can warp the mind, causing neuroses in extreme circumstances. The need is there for the mind to relieve this pressure, to release it. These clashes tend to focus on two topics, violence and sex. We have urges to harm others and or sleep with them. The id is saying, go, 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 while the superego is saying, no, no, no. The superego will not allow the id to act on these impulses. But there must be a safety valve. Jokes. They're just saying, not doing, but they let us blow off the steam that was building up. This, Freud argues, is why much of our humor is composed of ethnic and dirty jokes. These topics reflect the majority of the conflicts between the id and the superego that take up our mental energy. But use humor to drain this pent-up tension, satisfying the id by being titillating and the superego by restraining itself from acting. This is why humor is necessary. The feeling one gets from the joke, the release, the pleasure, means that humor is effective in saving the mind from itself. Just like with Kierkegaard, there are intrinsic contradictions that steer us away from full rationality. And just like in Kierkegaard, we need humor to account for these contradictions in a way that allows us full and functional humanity. Now, the mid-20th century saw a radical shift in the scientific world away from the romanticism of the 19th century and back towards a thoroughgoing, rational, scientific view of the mind. With this move came a rejection of the Freudian notions of a subconscious. Psychology is a science, and science deals with that which is observable. As Karl Popper argued, the subconscious is not observable. Therefore, it, and all of Freudian psychoanalysis, is not scientific. It is to be rejected. What replaced it was a mechanistic picture of mind. The mind is just the brain. And what is the brain? An organic computer. With CAT scan and PET scan technologies, we could watch the brain work in real time. We discovered how neurons work individually and in concert. we found the roles played by chemical neurotransmitters in facilitating electrical signals. We came to see which parts of the brain were responsible for which functions and how those functions were carried out. The brain was thought to be just a squishy neural network. At the same time, we began building non-squishy networks capable of human-like rational work. Computers could calculate like the human mind. Computers could play chess like the human mind. Computers could do lots of things a human mind could. But is it possible to take the next step? Instead of machines that act as if they think, is it possible to build a computer that actually can think? Is artificial intelligence possible? A lot of thought and effort has gone into that project in the late 20th and early 21st century. But a version of our question has just been asked. Matthew Hurley, Daniel Dennett, and Reginald Adams Jr.'s book, Inside Jokes, Using Humor to Reverse Engineer the Human Mind, I think is one of the best books in the history and philosophy of humor. They don't merely ask whether artificial intelligence could have a sense of humor, but rather argue that it would be necessary for all intelligence to have a sense of humor. Humor, they contend, is related to a reasoning faculty needed by any intelligence, computerized or with a human brain, to live in the world. Now, when we picture a robot with awareness, say Data on Star Trek, the robot is always rational and capable of interaction, but lacking the ability to feel, lacking emotion, lacking in passion. This lack always implies a corresponding lack of humor. Hurley, Dennett, and Adams argue that this is completely wrong. Any neural network, organic or man-made, that has consciousness, they contend, must have a sense of humor. Any mind capable of interacting with the world will have to be endowed with a faculty that is like a sense of humor. A sense of humor, they argue, is necessary for a human mind or a human-like mind. The first step in their argument is to object to the entire pretext of the debate we've been tracing through intellectual history. Is the human mind rational or is it emotional? We saw the ancient Greeks and the European Enlightenment thinkers contending that we need to reject passion for reason in order to be fully human. The Romantics of the 19th century argued that we need to embrace irrationality to be human. Hurley, Dennett, and Adams argue that this is a false dichotomy. It's a false choice. There is not a distinction between reason and emotions. There are rational emotions. Reason and the passions are necessarily intertwined. What we think is connected to what we feel, and what we feel is connected to what we think. There's a reason why we find symmetry and elegance beautiful. There's a reason why we equate beauty and truth. There's a reason why the false, the immoral, and the ugly are connected in our mind. We are wired to have emotional reactions to the rational and irrational. It's not a difficult argument to make in terms of evolutionary development. Once we evolved the capacity for thought, we could use memory to our advantage. Our ancestors needed to remember which choices are mistakes that could lead to harm or death, and which choices are valuable for survival and health. The body developed the ability to reward good choices and punish bad choices. If something was bad to eat, we would react with disgust to the smell or taste. If, on the other hand, we came across something containing fat or sugar, hard to find substances in the wild, but great sources of quick and easy energy, then the body would reward us. This is why these things taste good and make us happy. The same sort of thing can be presumed to have happened with cognitive practices. Those which led to survival advantages would get a physical reward of neurochemicals that yield pleasure. Those that were disadvantageous would trigger discomfort-causing agents to be released. Thus, we have an emotional component to our rationality. We cannot disentangle what we feel from what we think. What we think, though, can be very advantageous, especially once we have developed brains sophisticated enough to be able to store all sorts of memories and, more importantly, to take those memories and use them to predict what is likely to happen in novel circumstances. If I find myself in a new context, I search my data banks for